What I would like to do to concentrate on today is one aspect of the Haggadah. And this is a primary aspect of the Haggadah that we're going to be focusing on. And we're going to develop it into five layers. Five layers of meaning. So for those of you who like to say things at the Seder, one can take different layers of them. Or we can just try to understand each of these particular layers. And because we learn Tanakh together, so it's going to have a global Tanakh picture as well, not just the particular spin of it that we see in the Haggadah itself. So the question, the part of the Haggadah that we're going to be focusing on is Arami Oved Avi. Now, I was trying to get hold of, and I didn't succeed getting hold of a article children's Haggadah. And there are many wonderful things about the Oshkosh children I got, and one of them is
I don't think there's anything wonderful about it. That
Orange
scroll.
No. But
the children's Haggadah is a picture book.
There's a particular unique thing about this Haggadah which makes it very easy. Makes our picture easier, is that they take the section called Arami Ovid Avi, and they take what is essentially four psukim, and they put them in different colors, embolded. And then each part that we learn out a little bit and we discuss, they put the bold in that same color. So you can sort of see the picture of what's going on. Now, this is important because, you know, when we're reading through these Haggadahs, which have, like, you know, that much of Hebrew and that much writing on it, you just keep going and you sort of, it seems like one long train. So it's important to get to see structure, overall structure. So just going back, what does the Mishnah tell us about what part of this, parts of the Seder that we have? Besides the fact of the things that we eat, the Mishnah only tells us about Manishtana. Then it says there's a point called Maschinim Bignusim Asayim B'Shevach, which means that we start off with the disgraceful beginnings and we end with the redemption. And the Gemara explains that there's two starts. One is Avodah Mayinu, our physical servitude, which is in Egypt, and then spiritual servitude, which is that our forefathers were serving Avodah Zarah. So those are three points we have in the Mishnah. Then the Mishnah says the following. This is in source one. It says Maschil Gnus Mesayim Shevach. That's what we just mentioned on page one. The Doresh Me'arami Avod Avi Ad Sheyigmar Kol HaParsha Kula. You Doresh, which means you're expanding the Parsha of Arami Avod Avi until you finish that Parsha. That's what we know. That's another component we have. And then the Mishnah goes on to say, and we finish with the brachas of the bracha at the end with a little bit of Hallel and the last bracha of about future redemption. That's all we know from the Mishnah. Okay, so just structurally, starting with two, there's Manishtana, which is sort of the question framework moving on. Then there's two points of Gnus, which we start with. One is our physical servitude, and then our spiritual servitude. And then suddenly, Doresh Me'arami Oved Avi. This Arami Oved Avi forms essentially the heart of the Seder, the heart of the expansion of the Seder, which is what we have. And then finally, the Hallel and saying Pesach Matzah Morar, which is Rabban Gamliel at the end of it there. That's all we have. So at the heart of it, this is really a worthwhile venture trying to understand why this particular section was chosen for us for the Seder. So just to frame it as a question, first of all, Arami Ovid Avi appears where in the Torah? What is Arami Ovid Avi in the Torah? It appears in where?
Bereshit.
Not in Bereshit, but it's talking about Yaakov. It's referring to Bereshit, but that section of the Torah is not in Bereshit. It occurs in Bikurim, which is in Devarim, the very end of everything. In a parasha completely non-germane to the whole Yetzias Mitzrayim episode altogether. So with your permission, I'd like to just read that very small, short section of the Torah, that's the expanded version of what's going on in Bikurim, with our eyes keenly open to why it would be that the author of the Haggadah would choose it to be the heart of the expansion of the Haggadah. Okay, so that's what we should... Let's go through those psukim and try to work out, because the question in the back of our minds should be, just coming in with an agenda, is why is it that we should be searching amidst Kisavoy, at the very end of the Torah, when Moshe is giving his last speech, for a rehashing of Yetzias Mitzrayim, when we have the real deal in Shmois, in Va'era, in Boy, in Beshalach. We have it all there. So why would the author of the Haggadah go and search around in the end of Devarim to find us something which is a repetition of the Exodus? And that becomes the central part, one of the only things the Mishnah actually mentions about the section of Magid as being our expansion point. Okay, so with that agenda in mind, let's take a look at the actual parasha, the expanded version of the parasha, which appears on the first page. So this is in Dvarim Perek Chof Hei, the beginning of Parashas Kisavoy, as the third word of the second and third word of the pasuk indicates. When you will come to the land, that Hashem will give to you as an inheritance, you will actually inherit it, possess it, and you will dwell in it. That's when this mitzvah takes place, is when you actually own and settle in the land. Then you shall take mereshis kopri ha'adama. You shall take from the first fruit of the land, asher tavi me'aratzecha, which you'll bring from your land, asher Hashem lekecha nasein lach, that which Hashem has given to you. V'samta batele, you'll place it in a basket. V'alachta el hamakom ashichar Hashem lekecha l'shaken shemoy sham. And you'll go with it in this basket to the place which Hashem chose to rest His shkina in, which was in the first stage, the Mishkan, and later on in the Mikdash. Right. So this must continue all those years. Uvaso ala kohen asher yihyeh b'yamimahem. You shall come to the priest who's in those days. V'amarta lov, and you shall say to him, Higaratzi hayom l'Hashem elokecha. I'm telling you today, in front of God, ki vasi al aretz, I arrived in the land, asher nishba Hashem l'avosen los islon, in the land which God swore to give to our fathers. V'lokach atene ha'kohen atene miyodecha, and the priest will now take the basket from your hands. V'inicho, you'll place it lifnei ha'mizbach Hashem elokecha, in front of the altar. Then, you will speak out loudly, lifnei Hashem Elokecha, in front of Hashem your God, Arami Oved Avi. This is Vanisa Vamarta, and he will say in front of lifnei Hashem Elokecha, in front of God, Hashem your God, Arami Oved Avi. An Armenian tried to destroy my father. Now, I will admit at this point in time that that's not the only way to read those words. There are different ways to read those words that the Mephoreshim go to, but taking the Haggadah's explanation of it, just because that's what we're working with now, the way to understand it is Arami Oved Avi, that an Armenian tried to destroy my father, which is referring to Lavan trying to destroy our forefather Yaakov. There are other explanations. It could be that our forefather was lost, and then he was lost in walking around. It could be referring to different people. It's not explicitly this way, but the Haggadah clearly interprets it as Lavan and Yaakov. Okay, that's the framework we're working with. Then, Vayerid Mitzrayma, then he went down to Egypt. Vayagar Sham Bimsei Ma'at, he dwelled there with a few numbers. Vayisham Lagoy Gadol Vatzum V'Rav, and he became a great nation. So this is actually the first pasuk that the Haggadah pulls out. What is the theme of this pasuk? What would the summary of this sixth stage of Egypt be in this pasuk?
Success.
Is small beginnings to great successful endings, right? That's point number one of the first section, which the Haggadah is going to expand. It's going to take each one of these words and expand it into much longer. Point number two. And the Mitzrim afflicted us and they placed on us great work. So, point number two. What's the next stage of the story that the Haggadah is saying? Is enslavement. Okay, so there's small beginnings to success or exponential growth. Then we have enslavement. And then we have Anitzak El Hashem Elokei Avoseinu. We called out to God. Vayishma Hashem Es Kolenu. God listened to our voices. Vayares Onyenu Ves Amolenu Ves Lachatzenu. And He saw our suffering, our oppression, and toil and oppression. Those are the summary of the third section is calling out, being the response of God. You see, it's divided up very nicely. Each pasuk is a different theme over here. And finally, Vayotzeinu Hashem Mitzrayim v'yad chazaka v'zrinan tzuya. Hashem took us out with this a strong hand and outstretched arm, v'mora gadol v'mosos v'mosim, and with these great signs and wonders. Now, at this point in the Haggadah, after many, many pages in your Haggadah, which has expanded this and explained each of these, each detail, each word to what it means, we're quoting all over to explain what this means. At this point in time is when we start pulling out the wine out of the cup and putting in the Dam Tzvardeya, and then we go on to the Tzias Mitzrayim, and then we get to really the end of Maggid, where Rabban Gamliel, the three things, Pesach, Matzah, Morah.
Never happens that fast.
This is definitely the summarized version, right? But the interesting thing actually is that we quoted four psukim over here, and the actual Mikra Bikurim actually goes on. Mikra Bikurim actually has another stage in this. Remember, this is all somebody's speech. This is the picture you have over here, is a man holding a basket, putting it in front of the coin and speaking. Okay, so the continuation of his speech is as follows: Vayivienu al hamakom hazeh, and he brought us to this place. Vayiten lanu ha'aretz hazos, and he gave us this land. Eretz zavas chalav dvash, a land flowing of milk and honey. Va'ata, and now hinei vayisi es reishis pri adamo. I have now brought the first fruits of my land. Hashem osatali Hashem, which God has given me. Vinehto, and he'll place it lifnei Hashem lakecha, and he places it in front of God. Vishtacha visa lifnei Hashem lakecha, and he shall bow down. You shall rejoice in all the good. You shall rejoice with everything that God has given you. You, the Levi, the convert, which live amongst you. So now, that is Mikra Bikurim. That is where the Baal Haggadah, the author, decided to pull this, the centerpiece of the Haggadah, and expand it. Okay, so the question on the table is, just having read through it here, and I admit we went very fast, but just to get a synopsis of what we just did, of the parasha of Aramiyahu Edavi, why is it that this is the choice? Why is this the choice centerpiece of the Haggadah, which we're going to be expanding upon? So, anything out there, just before as I said, we're going to go through, time permitting, five layers of understanding what seems to be a random section of the Torah to be highlighting the centerpiece of the Haggadah. But anything out there?
It's the birth of the nation, how it evolved from one stage to the next when they were redeemed.
Right, but that occurred in real. This is repetition. It happened in real time in Shmos, meaning okay. That was live. This is the broadcast afterwards, right? Right. So the first and most obvious attack at this particular topic, and a number of people point this out. The Malbim Sagot already points this out. Is, as Esther said, is that if let's say I were to pull out a chumash and I have four parishes to choose from, right? So where am I going to start? Well, the Jews, and then I'm going to start talking about. Well, I have to give a little bit of introduction, right? So the Jews went down, and there was Yaakov, and then. And then I'm going to start saying, okay, well, there was affliction. Basically, I would get a summary, a structure, which would be somewhat similar to this. So why not choose a summary which is already pre-made for us, right? This is a perfect summary of the structure. You can get the skeleton structure and now insert the meat, right? So on the most simple level, just this serves a very convenient way of doing this, which now we can expand to the degree we want and can contract to the degree we want. Sorry, Ruth, what are you saying?
Gratitude and remembering that even though this person who's bringing the Bikurim worked the land, it's not his work, it's Hashem. Like it's bringing us back.
So two very valid points over here. So what Ruth is saying is, number one, is there is the notion of Hakaras HaTov, which is this idea of Mikra Bikurim, is recognizing the good. That's one notion. I want to expand on these. And the other thing, the me. Right, so the experiential now. So I'm going to deal with each one of those separately. But I'm going to expand it in an order. So I'm going to come back to your points, which are both very valid points as well. So these are all very, very worthwhile points, and I'd like to expand each one as we go. First is just as Esther pointed out, is that this is a perfect summary. This is a summary in four psukim of an entire expanse of 210 years. So this is perfect. We can expand it as we want. That's point number one. But point number two is just also, did you notice some of the word parallels? Did you notice some of the word parallels to the Haggadah over here? What? Well, italicized the italicize the Vihigaritza Hayom. That the way that this telling is expressed as Vihigaritza, that you'll tell over. Okay, the Haggadah is called the telling over ceremony. But also, do you notice in Apostle K, it says, Va'anisa va'amarta, you will express out loud, or you express articulately. Now that word Va'anisa is relevant because Matzah is called in the Torah Lechem Oni, which one of the explanations is Lechem She'onim Olav Devarim Harbe, something which you expound or articulate concepts over. So just in terms of the word parallels, there are a few interesting word parallels out there, which is that this Va'anisa Amarta expressing clearly is related to the notion of matzah being lechem oni. Okay, just in terms of parallels. But if you take
what,
a little bit deeper, that was in Pasuk Hei Vav, Nisav Amarta. I italicize those two connections, which I think are meaningful. But let's get even better. If you are writing the Haggadah, now if you're setting out how this night is going to be memorialized, which it may already have been, it may be reflecting the way it is. But let's say you're trying to create more of a rigid structure of how this night is going to be played out in future generations. This is a perfect paradigm for a number of reasons, Mikra Bikurim, because as you notice, not only is it a drama which involves speech, it involves action as well. Meaning it's involving cutting your fruits, bringing them up, and you should know there's a whole procession. The Chazal explained that there was a procession where there would be this bull, which had its ears covered in gold, with an olive branch in its head, over its horns, and they'd bring up this bull with the basket, and there'd be a flute playing until they got to Jerusalem. They'd come to Jerusalem, they'd bring it to the Kohen, he'd place it down, then he'd talk to him, then he'd pick it up and place it down again, and he'd bow down. This whole ceremony is an interdispersed speaking, acting, involvement, which is effectively what we're doing at the Haggadah. Meaning that the Haggadah is essentially not just speech, but an actual act of involvement. We cover up, we put away, we hide, we drink, we lean. There's a lot of actions going on over there as well, which are expressing the very words that we're involved with. Okay, the very words we're saying. So as a paradigm, as an example, this is a very good example of a parasha that would be meaningful for us structure-wise. Okay? But these are just external things, meaning this is summary, this is some words which relate, there's the notion of how it's structured. But now, three essential ideas, three inherent ideas which are worthwhile dealing with over here. So I'm going to try this. We only have 20 minutes, but let's try to get three distinct inherent ideas over here. One is that what is the parasha directly preceding Mikra Bikurim in the Torah? This is the beginning of Parashas Kisavoy. So what's the directly preceding paragraph?
Kisei.
Mm-hmm. What is the last section in Parashas Kiteitze? What is the last section of Parashas Kiseitze? We just read it a few weeks ago. Parashas Zohar is the last parasha in Kiseitze. Now, I'm just going to be building off the words of Rabbi David Silber from the Drisha Institute. Shout out there to Ruth sent through some stuff this morning, but the first approach is based on some thoughts by Rabbi David Silber, which I think is very intriguing, but I'd like to take it in my own direction. Just over here is that you may say, okay, well, Parashas Kisavo follows the Parashas Zohar. That's very nice. There are many sections of the Torah which are next to each other. We don't necessarily know why. But it seems that the Torah itself wants us to know that they're connected. Right? And how do we know that the Torah wants us to know that they're connected? Listen to the last pasuk in Parashas Zohar. V'ho'ya, b'haniach Hashem elokecha lecha mikol avecha misaviv. When God will leave you to be free from all your enemies around. When God, in the land which God gives you as an inheritance, then you shall wipe out Amalek. So first of all, you notice that the mitzvah of Michias Amalek only kicks into action when you get the land, which is exactly when Bikurim kicks into action. But it's not just the time frame, it's the same words. Did you hear them?
Yeah.
When Hashem gives you the land, nachala lirishta. That is when Amalek takes place. Is when Hashem gives you the land, nachala lirishta. Those are the starting words of this parasha, right? V'yokia kisavala aretz asher Hashem lakecha nosen lecha nachala virishta. Right, the land which you are going to inherit. Oh, this is actually I put it in source 3. This actual pasuk is in source 3 over there. This is when Hashem will give you the nachala lirishta. Notice also what is the verb used to describe Hashem giving us the land, giving us freedom from our enemies, is the word bahaniach. When Hashem will give us freedom. Did you notice that that's the operative verb in Parashas Bikurim, twice over, at the beginning and the end. In Pasuk Dalet, v'hinichai, you'll place the basket there, and at the end, v'hinachtai. That is the bookends of Bikurim. So it would seem, from the way the Torah frames this, the parasha of Bikurim, there must be some form of connection to the preceding section of Amalek. Just in the connections of the words and the way it's being told to us. Operating at the same time frame, within the same context of words. Why so? That's the question. That's the question which is in front of us. But it's more than that, because I would like to ask another question which relates exactly to this point. If you were to reverse for a moment back to Parshas Yisroi, Yisroi arrives after all the incidents which has occurred to the Jews after leaving Egypt, and he arrives, and this is how the Torah describes what his involvement with the Jews. This is in section 4. Vayishma Yisro Kohen Midian. So Yisro, the priest of Midian, hears Chosein Moshe, who happens to be the father-in-law of Moses. Es kol asher asa Elokim leMoshe uliYisrael amoy. He hears everything which God did to Moshe and the Jews, the nation of Israel. Ki yotzi Hashem es Yisrael miMitzrayim. What did he hear? Clarification that he took the people of Israel out of Egypt. Further on, after the interlude of his introductions, Vayisaper Moshe lechosno es kol asher asa Hashem leparo leMitzrayim al ados Yisrael. He tells Moshe, explains to him everything that's occurred to them. Es kol atzlo Hashem atzasam baderech vayatzilem Hashem. Everything that's happened along the way that God saved them from. Vayichad Yisrael. Why is Yisrael happy? Because of al kol atzlo asher asa Hashem leYisrael asher itziloi miyad Mitzrayim. That he's so happy that he sees that Hashem saved the Jews from Egypt. So if you're to now interview Yisroi, just flip back. If you're to reverse these millennia and interview Yisroi at this point, what is it? What really flipped the switch? What made you come? What was the incident which really made you so excited? It seems very clear from the psukim that it's Egypt, right? It's the Jews being redeemed from Egypt. That seems to be what the psukim are telling us, which is therefore a problem or somewhat perplexing. Why the Midrash, Michilta, inserts another few options over here. Midrash, at the bottom of the page, says, Vayishma, ma shmua shama uba. What did he hear that made him come? Milchemes Amalek shama uba. He heard about the war against Amalek. Shehi ksuva betzidai, which was written beforehand, divrei Rabbi Yeshua. So Rabbi Yeshua is inserting over here, Amalek, further on in the Midrash, on the next page. Vayisaper Moshe lechosno, lemoshcho, lekarvo letorah, eis kol asher asa Hashem. What was everything which God did? Shenosan Torah l'amo Yisrael, es kol atalah b'mitzrayim, asher matzasem alayom v'aderech zilmuchem asamalek. So the Midrash adds in a whole bunch of other ideas over here, one of them being Amalek. Now the question I'd like to ask is, isn't this being disingenuous to the text itself? Meaning, isn't the Midrash suggesting something which doesn't seem to be expressly in the text? Now you might argue, as the Midrash is arguing, Baderech is the incidents which occur along the way. So that's certainly over there. But at the beginning, it sounds like, and certainly what Yisro is being happy about, it sounds like it's the idea of being saved from Egypt. So where is Amalek featuring in this whole dialogue over here that the Midrash sees that it's so important to insert? And part of the reason may be is exactly the juxtaposition that we're talking about in Kisava Kisetze. The Torah seems to frame understanding and appreciating the exodus of Egypt in the context of Amalek. Why so? Because they're diametrically opposed to one another. God saving a downtrodden people is the diametric opposite of a nation taking downtrodden people and killing them and attacking them. We can understand and we can appreciate God's salvation so much more once we've seen what evil is when taking downtrodden people and doing the opposite. Which is actually a point Rav Hirsch makes in Ki Tzeitze. He makes on this very point over here. He says, the very opposite to this picture of the national characters in Source 5, of a people woven out of justice and the duties of love, which only sees its power and its future in conscientious faithfulness to duty, and through whose example the exclusive devotion to duty will ultimately in the future be participated in by the whole of mankind, is presented by a great nation, this is one sentence by the way, is presented by a great nation like Amalek, which only finds its strength in the might of its sword and its love of glory in treading down all unprepared weaker ones. Right, so the notion of Amalek, why does it represent? Why is it the antithesis of God in the world? Is because it represents taking advantage of the weak, taking advantage of people who can't yet help themselves. They attack the back, the stragglers, the people who may have been excluded from the Ananiah covenant according to one version. So that is what Amalek represents. Once we see what they do, we can appreciate Exodus so much more. Which is perhaps why the Torah frames it in Kisetse and Kisavoi How do we understand the whole trajectory of Bikurim and that history of Yetzias Mitzrayim is through the eyes of Amalek, of what the opposite is. Which is perhaps why, when the Mechilta reads Yisrael, indeed Moshe is talking about being saved from Egypt. But how do you appreciate Egypt even more? Is through the story of Amalek. Amalek is there, yes, because it's appreciating, understanding what Egypt is. Which is maybe now why, when the Baal HaGadah, the author of this HaGadah, is trying to pull this message through for us. He's trying to choose something which is meaningful in appreciating Egypt. He chooses a place in the Torah which is directly preceded by the antithesis, the oppression of weak people, to understand what God did for us, rising up or bringing up these weak people. Which I may, just on my own notes, I think it may be meaningful that Arami Ovid Ovi, this section in the Haggadah, is directly preceded by V'hisha Amda, which is B'chol Dovador Amdim Olayinu L'chal Oseinu. Now, I'm not limiting, I don't want to limit that to Amalek, because it refers to all our oppressors. And Amalek is a specific unit of enemies. However, I do think it is meaningful that we're choosing a section in the Torah over here that is understood by its mirror opposite just beforehand, and in the formation in the Haggadah itself, there is B'chol Dovador followed by Rami Oved Avi. So I think that is a meaningful parallel, but it is predicated on our knowledge of the context, which is what we just did. So that is one layer over here from the context of the parasha that we're choosing.
The juxtaposition fits perfectly because the whole purpose of why we were enslaved in Mitzrayim was so that we could appreciate freedom. So it's another play on that.
Yes. Yes. So I still owe you a few now already. Now freedom as well. I want to come back to the freedom as well. I want to get back to that point as well. But so I want to play up on the point that you point out about that particular point, which the changeover is important in. So just to recap, we have a summary. We have a great summary of Yetzias Mitzrayim over here in four psukim. We have also a ceremony which operates in a way which the Seder is going to now be based on, involving not just speech, but also action. And then now layer three is the context. The context is framed in its opposite by the Amalek preceding it, which is perhaps maybe somewhat reflected in the Haggadah in the Vehisha Amda Arami Ovid Avi circle. Now, to get even closer into this, I'd like to add two more layers to this. Layer number four is the actual context of Dvorim. If the question is why was Dvorim chosen over Shmos, if that's the question that we're dealing with, Dvorim is very unique in the sense that it is being who are the people being talked to in Dvorim primarily? They are they're Israel, but we'll call it second generation, right? Second generation on the whole who've not experienced Exodus, right? They've not experienced it themselves. Yet, funnily enough, we have a number of times through the book that Moshe talks to them as if they did. Right? So one example would be in source number 6, this is in Parshas Vayeschanan, Hashem Elokeinu Koras Imanu Bris B'Chorev, God made a covenant with us in Chorev, Loyas Avoseinu Koras Hashem Esabris Azois, Ki Itonu Anachnu Eile Po Hayom Kulanu Chayim. God did not make the covenant with the people at Chorev, at Sinai, but with us. Now, a lot of them Farshim add in the word "also us," which seems to be the predominant view in the Mepharshim. But it's interesting that Moshe is talking to people who didn't experience Sinai and talking to them as if they did experience it. That's something just interesting to note over here, and that's perplexing. Why is he talking to them in these terms? So actually, it may be that he explains himself in a later point. This is much later on, near the very end of Dvarim. This is the end of Parshas Kisavoy, our parish of Mikra Bikurim. It says, Vayikra Moshe el Bnei Yisrael, this is after all the terrible, devastating curses, and says, he calls the Jews, Vayomer Alehem, Atem Risem Es Asher Asa Hashem Lenechem Be'eretz Mitzrayim. You saw what God did to you in the eyes of Egypt, the Pharaoh L'chol Avodov, to Pharaoh and all his servants, L'chol Arzoy and to all his land, you saw all these tremendous signs and miracles that occurred in Egypt. God did not give you the wherewithal, He did not give you the heart to understand, the eyes to see, the ears to hear until today. What does that mean? So the Mepharshim go to town. This is really. There's lots of layers in just what this really means. But on a simple chat level, it sounds like now through the context of history and through the context of Torah, understanding that history, you're able to gain the full picture of what really is what went on then. Meaning, you would think that if you have two people, you have an eyewitness and you have the person who read the documentary, right? That obviously the more reliable person is the eyewitness. So you go back to them. But it's interesting over here that somehow Hashem is saying that on the pshat level, and I agree that there are many other levels over here, that somehow the context, the seeing it from a context, seeing it from the view of history and Torah, somehow something is added over here from seeing the holistic picture of the soul experience. Perhaps. Which is interesting because Moshe is talking to a second generation. I know that some unfortunate point out that he's speaking to that fraction who actually were below 20, but it sounds like just from the pshat that he's talking to everybody over here. So somehow, even second generation now, he's saying that he's trying to bring to life through the Torah, through the history, what was experienced a generation prior, which is essentially where Rami Ovid Avi fits in as well. Because now I'm joining over here both Rabbi Silber and Rabbi Nathan Laufer. This is the first time in history that the Exodus has been summarized to people who haven't experienced it. Right? This is a generation who didn't experience Exodus. They didn't experience Yetzias Mitzrayim. And Moshe is summarizing it for them in the context of the book of Devarim, which itself is a book talking to people who weren't there as if they were there, because trying to bring them back, trying to bring through the context of the Torah and the history to what they didn't necessarily experience themselves. So that's where Arami Ovid Avi fits in. That's why perhaps we choose, what better place could we choose for a summary of the Exodus than Moshe Rabbeinu summarizing it for people who didn't experience it. Because after all, we're all people who didn't experience it.
Right, we're the second generation.
We're all the second generation and more than that. So this exists now as our paradigm. This is now the place we go to draw this summary for people who haven't experienced it. That might be another point why Devarim is preferable even to the experience itself which occurred in Shmos. That's something just to think about the context of Devarim as a whole. But now I'd like to just get the last point, and this is really something incredible. Okay, preferencing it really is incredible. So you just have to, okay.
Right.
This is all very interesting. This is incredible. So, okay. So,
write that down. Okay. Incredible.
So just to notice what we've done. We've looked at the importance of summary. We've looked at the importance of it being an example of this, the Haggadah ceremony. We've looked at it in the context of Amalek and the Near Parsha and Devarim as a whole. Okay, those are the four layers we've done now. Fifth layer and the last. Okay, so we'll try to pull this all together over here. Is think about this. Just think about the experience of this poor Jew. He lives, let's say, in the northern Galilee, right? He has a farm, right? And all he wants to do is eat his fruits. Comes the end of the year, he spent the entire time tilling the land, planting, watching, guarding. The fruit comes out. He sees a bud arriving. He has to run out to his field, tie a red string around it. Okay, similar to the ones you get at Kavar Rachel, not the same. This arrived beforehand. Okay, so he ties a red string around the fruit, waits a few months, and each of the fruits that he sees coming out, he tears his red string on. He arrives around the time of Shavuos, as all the fruits have now come into full bloom. He has to take them all, and instead of just sitting down to his family and saying, "Wow, what a busy season it's been," he has to go now trek up to Jerusalem with this whole ceremony. Right, he takes the oxes we mentioned before, and there's the music. He arrives in Jerusalem, and instead of just saying, "Okay, where do I make my donation? Now let's go back," and he has to make this whole proclamation, and he's now suddenly zipping back over centuries of history. He's talking about his great 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 grandfather Yaakov and Lavan having this experience in Armenia. Then suddenly he is talking about the Jews in Egypt. So we've moved down south to a different continent about the Jews, and they're coming out. And then it's all and this all now comes to a fore with who? With me in the land of Israel, because I'm the end of this, right? And then he's able to eat his fruit. What is Bikurim telling somebody? Bikurim is the process of realization that you're not alone. You're not a dot in history, but you're the end of a long chain of events and a long chain of people. You are the end of something which is in context. It's about the tradition of what led you here to this point. We're forcing this this realization down the throats of every person who grows fruit in the land of Israel, effectively. Every person has to have his eyes opened to realize that he's at the end of a historical process. But isn't that exactly what we're doing at the night of Pesach? Mm-hmm. The night of Pesach is essentially the greatest point of moving on, of tradition, of the idea of connection. I just spoke to a lady today, and it was such a refresher. She said she loves Pesach so much. It's such a family time. It's the best time to be able to connect with people. That's not usually the thing you hear about Pesach, unfortunately. But it's got bad press, unfortunately. But with the busyness of the season, but Pesach is a time in a certain time of connection, of where the family, generation after generation, three, maybe sometimes even four generations, can sit around the same table and experience and talk about the same events and contextualize them. It's that linking back. It's your children asking. It's always about the children and the parents, the children and the parents. It's the same idea. We're this realization that we're part of a greater whole. But it gets better than that, right? Okay, so it's of course the idea. This is modeled after the idea of transmission, of movement throughout history, which is what Bikurim and the Haggadah represent. But let's take it back. Who are the characters of the Mikra Bikurim? Who are the people that we're talking about? Who are the protagonists and antagonists of our story? Olavan and Yaakov, according to the way the Haggadah actually takes it. And so what's unique about Olavan and Yaakov? Lavan and Yaakov are interesting in this sense, that Lavan, let's start with Yaakov. Yaakov is described in Parshas Vayechi, in the blessings, he describes himself as Even Yisrael. In Psalm 7, Midei Avir Yaakov, Misham Ro'e Even Yisrael. He calls himself the Rock of Israel. What does that mean? Why is a rock relevant to his name? Rashi says this is actually, the Rashi just below it says, Even Yisrael, Losh Notrikon. It is an acronym. This may not be the right term for acronym, but it is a contraction of the word Av Ubein, father and son. Avon Ubenin Yaakov Uvonov. Mm-hmm. Why? Do you notice that the Nun of Av and Ben is molded together in the word Evan? Right? It's taken over twice. Av and Ben, father and son. Which is obviously meaningful because of Yaakov, because after all, who was Yaakov? Yaakov was the person who took the ideas and beliefs of a family and expanded that into a nation. Because from him split forth the 12 tribes, which became the core basis of Yisrael. No longer was it just Avram and Yitzhak and a family, it became Shvatim, which proceeded into tribes. But more than that, Yaakov, of all the three forefathers, was the only one who had all his children stay in the fold. Right? Because Avram had a Yishmael and other children, Yitzhak had an Esav, Yaakov had Mitasa Shlem, which means that all his children remained in the fold. So he is the ideal of transmission, of the notion of continuation, because all his children remain within that his tradition. That's Yaakov. That's Yaakov Even Yisrael. But if you're to take this seriously, Rabbi Elchanan Adler of YU makes a point. What's the name Lavan? Lavan's name is Lo Ben. If Yaakov is Aven Ben, then Lavan's name is Lobain, right? The negation of childhood or connection between child and parents. Which is interesting because what's one of the first times that Lavan appears in Tanakh is he appears, first of all, when he meets Eliezer, but later on in the conversation when Eliezer turns to the family and says, I'd like to ask for Rivka's hand in marriage for Yitzhak, master, what is the response? The response is, in the next box, this is what Eliezer's words. He says, please tell me if you're going to do kindness with my master. If you're not going to marry Rivka, I'll go to the left or the right or the left. Vayan Lavan b'Suel vayamru. Lavan and b'Suel answered. Who's b'Suel? Who's b'Suel? B'Suel is his father. And Rashi points out that he jumped his father. He preceded his father. So what do you see? Lavan represents the discontinuation, right? He's prepared to go after and kill his own children when he sees that Yaakov's run away. He exists as he is right there and then. He is only now, the present. Yaakov is context. Yaakov is history. Yaakov is transmission, before to after, with in between as me. That's what Yaakov represents. So the protagonist and antagonist of this of our Mikra Bikurim episode, which follows through into the Haggadah of the two individuals who perhaps the one aspect of their existence is continuation, tradition, movement, not or the lack of it. And for the last point is that's perhaps one of the aspects of Chayrus, of freedom, because there's one of the things which a slave lacks is the notion of Yichus. We say halachically a slave is not halachically related to his parents. Only when you gain freedom do you have that connection between family members and different generations. Where was the first time that we find a slave? Where was the first slavery in Tanakh? Was right over here on this page, of course. So surprisingly enough, it's with Noach. Is when Canaan, who's his grandson, embarrasses him. There's a number of options of what he actually did, but the point is he did not give him the due respect as a grandfather, which the other, his uncles, had to do and cover his father up when Noach was naked, right? So as a response to the lack of respect of the previous generation comes slavery, which is an interesting connection why it is that when we celebrate slavery, our freedoms from slavery, we celebrate the connection, our yichus, our connection back all those ways, which is in the model of Bikurim, which is that notion of tradition and continuation. Anyway, thank you everybody much, very much.